Welcome back to Robin Stale Revisited, the podcast where we take a deep dive into the incredible, surprising, and sometimes downright wild history right beneath our feet in our own backyard. I'm Pete Ritchie, and I smile every time I say I'm the president of the Robin Stale Historical Society.
And I'm Crystal Boyd, just a regular member of the Robin Stale Historical Society. And, you know, Pete, when people are driving down West Broadway today, they see something that doesn't really look like New Hope, but I'd still describe it as peaceful and somewhat urban. If you could hop into a time machine and go back about a century to the 1920s, I'd see a streetcar rolling through Robbinsdale that was generating a cultural shockwave that disrupted American media, built a multi-million dollar publishing empire, and eventually birthed one of the most legendary vacation destinations in the Midwest.
Yeah, you know, we were kind of a streetcar suburb, so that makes sense. And it really is mind-boggling when you look at the scale of it. If you've ever taken a trip up to Big Pelican Lake in the heart of Minnesota, you'll definitely know Breezy Point, that whole Brainerd Resort area. In its 1930s heyday, or really its 1920s heyday, it advertised itself to weary city slickers as America's finest summer playground. And it wasn't just hyperbole. The resort boasted all the luxury and high-class amenities of an elite Eastern hotel.
Well, yeah, and although many of Breezy Point's buildings were crafted from beautifully varnished pine logs, the rustic part completely stopped at the bark. When you stepped into a guest room, you had full electric lights, a private bath of shining tile, and an actual working telephone. And then downstairs, there was a world-class French chef preparing dinner, and maids and bellboys were at your beck and call. And even an English hostler was waiting at the stables to prep your thoroughbred.
But here's the kicker. There's a lot of folks relaxing up at that lake today that don't realize that Breezy Point's entire DNA is pure Robbinsdale. Growing up right here in Whizbang's hometown, you always heard the tale of Breezy Point. The resort was an ultimate passion project of an eccentric, unstoppable, larger-than-life visionary who put our town on the international map. Wilford Hamilton Fawcett, nobody ever called him Wilford. To history, he's simply Captain Billy.
And today we're going to stretch out the canvas to tell the whole epic multi-generational saga. We're talking about Captain Billy's early renegade years, the brilliant crew of local Fawcetteers who turned West Broadway into a printing juggernaut, and even illegal speakeasies hidden in the northern woods. And then we'll also take a closer look at the family he left behind, especially his daughter Marion, who carried a piece of this Robbinsdale legacy all the way to the end of the 20th century. So, pack your bags and hide the hooch, because we've got a lot of ground to cover.
Now, to truly understand how pulp publishing ended up centered right here in Robbinsdale, we have to trace Captain Billy's roots back to the very beginning. Long before he was an American icon, he was actually a Canadian import. Wilford Hamilton Fawcett was born across the border on April 29th, 1885 in Brantford, Ontario. His father, John Fawcett, and his mother, Maria Nielsen, were both born in 1849 and married in 1879. Now, John wasn't a publisher. He was a general practice doctor.
Really? So just a doctor? A backwoods doctor. Can you imagine? So Billy wasn't an only child either. He was part of a rapidly growing household. He had an older brother, also named John, born in 1880, and a younger brother, Roscoe, was born in 1886. But their dad's medical practice was destined for the expanding American frontier. In 1888, when Captain Billy was just 3 years old, the Fawcett family packed up everything they owned, left Canada behind, and crossed into America.
The family just kept expanding. The parents welcomed four more children into the mix, Margaret, Maria, Clarence, and Harvey. By the time the 1900 U.S. Census rolled around, 15-year-old Wilford Hamilton Fawcett was recorded as a typical everyday high school student, but a quiet life of academia and small-town routine just wasn't in his DNA. Billy was restless, and in June of 1901, right after completing the 10th grade, a 16-year-old Wilford decided he was done with school, and he entered the workforce, landing a job as a mail clerk for the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad.
Oh, can you imagine being a 16-year-old starting as a mail clerk on the railroad? I mean, just think about the grit that it took to do that job. I mean, you had to sort the mail on this roaring, soot-belching steam train shaking down the tracks. But he didn't really stick with the railroad for very long. In June of 1902, at the ripe old age of 17, he walked into a U.S. Army recruiting station and quit his mail job. The military paperwork from his enlistment paints a fascinating picture of the young volunteer. He stood just 5'5", with sharp brown eyes and brown hair, and his occupation was listed simply as clerk. They gave him a rifle and put him through basic training and shipped him straight across the Pacific Ocean into a geopolitical firestorm, the Philippines.
Going to the Philippines then, it wasn't like a peacekeeping mission like we think of today. To give our listeners some context, just 4 years before Billy joined up, the Spanish-American War had officially ended in 1899 with the Treaty of Paris. The treaty surrendered control of Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines to the United States, but the Filipino nationalists completely rejected American colonial rule. They wanted total independence, and they fought a brutal, agonizing three-year conflict known as the Philippine-American War.
And the human cost of that conflict was staggering. So over 20,000 Filipino soldiers and 4,000 Americans died, and an estimated 200,000 civilians lost their lives. And even though that official war ended right around the time that young Wilford arrived in the summer of 1902, the U.S. Army remained bogged down on the islands for an additional 10 years, fighting a bloody, grueling, guerrilla-style insurrection in the most remote jungle areas.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that 20,000 Filipino soldiers were soldiers that were fighting on both sides, both the American side and the side of the nationalists in the Philippines. And a young Wilford absolutely thrived in high-stakes, chaotic environments. In June of 1906, at the age of 21, Corporal Wilford Fawcett, I'm still having a hard time calling this guy Wilford, completed his initial three-year tour of duty. But instead of jumping on a boat, he chose to re-enlist for a second term. It was during the second tour in the dense Philippine wilderness that disaster struck. During a fierce clash, a Moro tribesman lunged at him, tearing through Billy's leg with a razor-sharp, wavy-edged crisp blade. And the wound was horrific. The military doctors took one look at the mangled flesh and told him his leg was doomed and should probably be amputated immediately.
But, you know, if there's one thing we know about Billy Fawcett, it's that he flat-out rejected orders when he didn't like them, and he sure as heck wasn't going to lose a limb. He refused the operation, packed up his gear, and received an honorable discharge at the rank of sergeant. That was in the summer of 1907. He came back to America and tracked down a legendary backwoods doctor who had a reputation for saving doomed limbs using alternative methods. And amazingly, it worked. And I kind of wonder, do you think he had that confidence because his dad had been a backwoods doctor?
This backwoods doctor term, what does that mean?
I don't know.
Are these guys applying snake oil? Maybe they just knew some folk remedies.
Licensed or not, this guy helped him keep his leg, so he gets back on his own 2 feet, resumes his old career as a railroad mail clerk. But this time around, the railroad stations him in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And the move to Minnesota changed everything. On October 29th, 1907, Wilford married his first wife, Claire Viva Myers, an Iowa native who was also born in 1885. The young newlyweds bought a house at 1555 Charles Street in St. Paul. And before long, the house was absolutely bursting at the seams. They had 5 children in rapid succession. First came twins in 1908, a boy, Wilford Jr., and a daughter, Marion. Over the next 5 years, they added 3 more boys to the bustling household, Roger in 1909, Gordon in 1911, and Roscoe in 1913.
Wow, so now they have this huge family of 7 people, and you might imagine a mail clerk's salary just wasn't cutting it anymore. Billy needed something faster and something that fed his love for excitement. So in 1914, he left the railroad for good and became a fast-talking, midnight-oil-burning police reporter for the Minneapolis Tribune, which is kind of an interesting gig. So he spends his nights chasing sirens, interviewing detectives, and writing gritty crime copy. So he's getting into this writing piece. Then the world went to war again. In 1918, at the age of 33, Billy felt the call of duty and enlisted back into the Army for World War I, or the Great War.
No, so this is a guy who didn't finish high school, but somehow gets a job as a journalist. So he likes to type. This time around, because of his age and the incredible expertise with a firearm, he didn't get shipped overseas. Instead, he stayed stateside, teaching marksmanship as a gunnery officer to thousands of young recruits at Camp Georgia down in Virginia. But he also put his newspaper skills to work, contributing content to the famous military publication Stars and Stripes. He was finally discharged in 1919, and he held the rank of captain. He returned home to Minnesota and proudly kept the title for the rest of his life. From now on, he's not Wilford, he's Captain Billy.
So Captain Billy is back in Minnesota as a civilian, and he decides to try his hand at the hospitality business. And this seems kind of in keeping with his extroverted personality. He opens up a lounge called the Army and Navy Club in downtown Minneapolis, which seems like perfect timing, right? Wrong. On January 17th, 1920, the Volstead Act and the 18th Amendment took effect. So prohibition is officially the law of the land, making the sale of alcohol a federal crime. Captain Billy's bar was forced to close its doors almost instantly, and Billy was broke. You know, he's standing on a street corner wondering, how is he going to feed his five kids?
Well, maybe prohibition will be an opportunity. But while he's working for Stars and Stripes and swapping stories with soldiers in France and Virginia, Billy collected a massive mental vault of saucy jokes, army humor, and stories that no official military publication would ever dare to print. He looked at the grim, serious reality of Prohibition-era America and decided to take a massive gamble. He risked his absolute last $500 to launch an anti-prohibition broadside, a civilian, joke-filled version of Stars and Stripes, where he could mock the teetotalers, shock the straight-laced prudes, and serve the public a heaping helping of what he affectionately called pedigreed bull.
Boy, I sure wonder what the conversations were like around the kitchen table. Like, hey, honey, I'm going to spend our last $500 and make this little pocket-sized digest. You know, by the way, I'm going to name it after myself, and the distinct whistling screech of an incoming artillery shell. So he names it Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. And instead of setting up shop on the crowded, expensive streets of Minneapolis, he looks northwest. He established the official offices of Whiz Bang right here in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, setting up at 4168 West Broadway Avenue.
The first issue of Captain Billy's Whiz Bang appears in October 1919, and it hit the stands and sold out the entire 5,000-copy print run in less than a week. Jazz Age America was absolutely starving for this kind of cheeky, irreverent, small-town humor. By 1922, the little joke book, edited right out of West Broadway, was selling over 300,000 copies a month. Almost overnight, the quiet agricultural suburb of Robbinsdale became an unexpected epicenter of American pop culture and humor.
So capitalizing on this success, Billy, along with his brothers, Harvey and Roscoe, officially founded Fawcett Publications. They outgrew their first office and took over the upper floors of the Security State Bank building right on Broadway. Robbinsdale suddenly became a powerhouse of the printing industry. And from those upper floors, they began launching a massive empire of hit periodicals. They rolled out the magazine True Confessions in 1922, and that became a monster nationwide hit, followed by Hollywood Magazine, Screenplay, Mystic Magazine, and a thrilling adventure pulp called Triple X Magazine. Between 1921 and 1924, Fawcett Publications spent an astronomical $2.2 million on printing and publishing alone, boasting a massive annual payroll, with Robbinsdale serving as the proud beating heart of the entire operation.
But as Captain Billy's business empire skyrocketed into the stratosphere, his personal life began to fracture under the weight of his success. In 1920, he and his wife Claire went through a bitter divorce. Claire retained full custody of their five children. However, the legal agreement included a very specific clause. Every single summer, the kids would pack their bags and spend 3 full months with their larger-than-life father. The following year, in 1921, Captain Billy married his second wife, Annette Fisher, a South Carolina native who was born in 1897.
Fueled by his Robbinsdale-made millions, Captain Billy decided to purchase 280 acres of pristine, densely wooded shoreline on Big Pelican Lake near Brainerd, Minnesota. And he set out to build the ultimate wilderness retreat, Breezy Point Resort. And when construction began on the resort's first 26 well-appointed, fully electrified cabins, Billy didn't forget where his money came from. He deliberately named those cabins alphabetically after the very streets of Minneapolis and Robbinsdale.
Yeah, and so if you drive around there, there's a York cabin, a Xerxes cabin, and they're still named that today. Imagine being young Marion Fawcett growing up in the 1920s. For 9 months out of the year, you're living a relatively structured, standard life with your mother, and they were in South Minneapolis on Lindale Avenue. Their house is still standing. But the second school lets out, and it's summer. Your dad whisks you away to this wild log-hewn kingdom in the North Woods. And let me tell you, it was a total three-month circus. Captain Billy didn't just drive up there to look after his resort. He was one of Minnesota's genuine aviation pioneers. He maintained a personal airplane and a seaplane, clearing out a runway on what is now the resort's traditional golf course. Three times a week, Captain Billy would famously fly back and forth, roaring through the skies between Big Pelican Lake and his publishing offices right here in Robbinsdale.
He even bought a magnificent Curtis Seagull flying boat from a Duluth businessman for $12,000.
$12,000? That's a lot of money in 1920s.
Well, it's a flying boat.
Yeah.
And he also hired a talented daredevil Robbinsdale airfield pilot named Walter Bullock to pilot it full time. Bullock's job was to give free aerial rides to any resort guest who was brave enough to step into the cockpit. I mean, this is still pretty early. So in the summer of 1921, the Brainerd Dispatch reported that over 250 guests took a spin in the sky, with Bullock taking 23 people aloft in a single day. And this next part is a little scandalous. So Bullock meets a young lady. She's actually still a schoolgirl and becomes his sweetheart. Her name is Lillian Larson. Well, Bullock convinces her to drop out of school and elope with him, and they spend the entire summer living out a high-flying romance at Breezy Point. Her parents probably had some thoughts on that. But anyway, Robbinsdale ingenuity and romance were literally driving the resort's entertainment.
If flying in the sky wasn't thrilling enough for young Marion and the guests to watch, Captain Billy had an absolute death trap waiting on the water. He built a custom flat-bottom propeller-driven watercraft powered by an actual roaring airplane motor, and he named it the Whiz-Bang Boat. And it would scream across the crystal clear waters of Big Pelican Lake at a terrifying 45 miles an hour, creating a deafening roar that echoed for miles across the water. And there's a picture of Marion in the Images of America, Robbinsdale book, where she's leaning up against this boat and looking like she's going to cause trouble.
What a life. By June 10th, 1925, Captain Billy opened the true crown jewel of the property, the Grand Breezy Point Lodge. He spared absolutely no expense, hiring the prestigious architectural firm Magny and Tussler, the very same masterminds who would later design the iconic Fauché Tower in Minneapolis. Billy imported elite Finnish and Norwegian carpenters who hand-sculpted the entire massive structure out of full, round Norway pine logs using a complex system of wooden pins, scribing, cupping. So this means they built the entire giant structure without using a single metal nail. And I have to say, that's actually not very Robbinsdale, because Robbinsdale is the birthplace of the nail gun.
That's right. It's not.
So for this building, they get the logs from the railroad on the trains. They come from Pequot Lakes and were trucked to the site by an army of workers.
Yeah. So when it opened, it was a marvel of the Midwest. It stretched 160 feet from the grand entrance to the back of the dining room and cost a fortune to complete. It boasted 140 modern rooms, a bowling alley, a beauty parlor, and a massive, friendly six-table billiard room lined with green wool tables where the pool balls were carved from genuine elephant tusk ivory. The main dining hall was the largest in the entire state of Minnesota, easily seating 700 guests on busy weekends. It featured colossal stone fireplaces standing 12 feet wide and climbing 44 feet high. The massive boulders used to build them were hauled across the frozen ice of Pelican Lake by horse-drawn sleds from Gooseberry Island during the dead of winter.
And the luxury inside that rustic dining hall was unmatched. Table settings featured heavy sterling silverware, blue glass goblets, white linen napkins, and custom base plates adorned with hand-painted peacocks and a gold-inlaid BPL border. Those plates cost an astronomical $75 a piece in 1920s dollars, and Captain Billy instituted a strict rule. No peacock plate was ever allowed to be washed with another dish. Just a stone's throw away, Captain Billy built his own residence, a spectacular Y-shaped, 9-bedroom log mansion that would eventually be listed on the National Register of Historic Places.
Now let's talk about Captain Billy's absolute passion, speed, and luxury, because it caused some major fireworks back home. Billy bought a high-powered, incredibly expensive Stutz Bearcat sports car. He loved to open up the throttle and roar down the unpaved roads of Robbinsdale and up to the resort. In 1926, a local stonemason named Charlie Skog built a grand, solid stone gateway at the entrance of Breezy Point. But Captain Billy's ex-wife, Claire, and his family were absolutely terrified that Billy was going to lose control of the Stutz Bearcat and smash himself right into the heavy stone pillars.
So what did Claire do? Without telling her husband, she took matters into her own hands. She ordered Charlie Skog to demolish the gateway immediately. Skog, wanting to stay on the family's good side, packed the pillars with sticks of dynamite and blew the gateway sky high. The deafening explosion brought Captain Billy sprinting out to the road. He's in a total panic. When Skog explained that he was just following the missus's orders, Captain Billy looked at the smoking rubble, turned to the stonemason, and calmly said, "Ignore my wife. Rebuild the gateway."
And they did. And while the resort looked like a wholesome family getaway on the surface, beneath the surface, it was a classic Prohibition playground. Deep in the basement of the lodge, safely hidden away from public view, Breezy Point operated a roaring illegal speakeasy bar and a high-stakes casino, complete with roulette wheels and slot machines leased out from an operator named Bob Hamilton. Local law enforcement made frequent midnight raids on the resort, trying to catch them in the act, but Hamilton always had an inside source. The second a tip-off call came from a friendly deputy, workers would frantically load the slot machines onto the backs of flatbed trucks and drive them deep into a hidden unmapped logging roads until the police left empty-handed.
He has a bootlegging pal named Charlie Saunders, who's the famous owner of Charlie's Cafe Exceptional in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And together, they smuggled premium booze all the way down from Canada on old logging roads and isolated train tracks. Sometimes Captain Billy's pilot friends from the Robbinsdale airfield would fly over the resort and drop buoyed canvas bags stuffed with liquor bottles directly into the waters of Breezy Bay, where waiting speedboats would fish them out of the water.
The illegal alcohol was stored safely inside Captain Billy's private house, and according to local legend, the big house was built entirely without a kitchen. Instead, a secret underground tunnel was dug leading directly from the basement straight into the lodge. Depending on who you ask, the tunnel was either used so Captain Billy could sneak over to the deli for a late-night sandwich, or it was the primary pipeline used to wheel cases of Canadian whiskey straight into the illegal casino. There was always dark whispers that the Chicago mob or high-profile gangsters were backing the resort. Captain Billy certainly fanned the flames of these rumors when Fawcett Publishing printed a lucrative one-shot Al Capone magazine, but there is zero evidence the mob ever set foot in the management office. Decades later, Captain Billy's son, Roscoe Kent Fawcett, flatly told the resort's general manager, "Father would have never allowed them on the property."
What do you know about this Al Capone magazine?
The rumor that went with it is he was very nervous about publishing it, and he stationed some Pinkerton security people around the Fawcett building here in Robbinsdale. He didn't want to get in trouble with the mob, but he wanted to make money. Turned out Capone loved it and wrote him a letter telling him so.
This is so thrilling. It's just such a flashy lifestyle. Instead of mobsters, though, Captain Billy filled his resort with pure Hollywood star power. Because Fawcett Publishing came of age right alongside the golden era of cinema, Billy used his massive media empire and screen fan magazines to lure the world's biggest celebrities deep into Minnesota pine country. Breezy Point became a playground for the elite. Literary giant Sinclair Lewis spent June of 1926 at the lodge, and when he wasn't furiously writing, Lewis could be found sitting at the lodge piano, happily singing hymns with guests. However, his severe alcoholism became such a liability that the resort had to assign dedicated employees just to watch him and escort him safely to bed when the bar shut down. But still, the northern air was pretty good for him. By August, he had finished half of the manuscript for his masterpiece, Elmer Gantry.
Other writers like Erskine Caldwell and Margaret C. Banning visited, along with the legendary Minneapolis Tribune journalist Cedric Adams, Dick Cullum, and Charlie Johnson. And then there were the stars of the silver screen. Legendary Hollywood actress Dolores Del Rio celebrated her 23rd birthday at the lodge in a blowout party hosted by Captain Billy when Del Rio and fellow starlet Clara Windsor arrived at the train depot. A massive crowd of locals turned out just in time to catch a glimpse of them. Rumors swirled that Captain Billy's brother Roscoe was dating the ultimate blonde bombshell, Jean Harlow, who frequented the resort along with Tom Mix, Lillian Gish, and boxing heavyweight champion Jack Dempsey.
This seems like the place to be. Sounds like they had a great time.
Yeah.
Part of it, in 1925, Captain Billy opened a pristine golf course carved out of 150 acres of dense woodland. To celebrate, he hosted an exhibition tournament featuring golf icon Walter Hagen. After the match, Billy, ever the competitor, took Hagen straight over to the trap shooting range to see if the golf pro could handle a shotgun, because Captain Billy was a pro marksman himself. In 1924, Captain Billy actually traveled to Paris, France, to serve as the manager of the U.S. Olympic trap shooting team. Out of 44 world-class shooters from 14 nations, Captain Billy took 18th place in the world with a score of 91. When he got back to the States, inspired by his time in Europe, he immediately published a highly successful magazine of naughty French prints. Woo! Back home, he designed world-class trap and skeet ranges for Breezy Point, making it the premier destination for the Midwest's most prestigious shooting tournaments.
While he was up north playing the ultimate host, the creative engine back down on West Broadway in Robbinsdale was running at an absolutely furious pace. In 1926, Fawcett expanded its comedy lineup, and he started printing a little thing called Smokehouse Monthly, the Calgary Eye Opener, and then he took over the notorious Jim Jam Gems.
Then came November 1928 and the launch of the historic first issue of Modern Mechanics, edited right out of Robbinsdale. The magazine became famous not just for science, but for entertainment, carrying the serialized sci-fi stories of John Carter and the Red Planet by the legendary Edgar Rice Burroughs. That same year, Billy added a second pulp magazine titled Battle Stories. To bring these wild tales to life, the Robbinsdale offices employed a legendary stable of illustrators, including Remington Schuler, Alvin Henning, George Rosen, Douglas Rolfe, Stuart Rouse, Norman Saunders, Alan Anderson, and Ralph Carlson.
So the brains behind the desks were a brilliant crew of local editors, known affectionately to the town as the Robbinsdale Fawcetteers, Jack Smalley, Ralph Dye, Al Ellard, and Westy Farmer. These guys were creative geniuses. In 1931, Westy Farmer actually designed the Mechanical Package magazine right out of Robbinsdale. Each issue came bundled with actual physical parts and a blueprint, some instructions, so readers could build their own working devices like a miniature steam engine or a functional telegraphy set right there at their kitchen table.
So they're doing all this great stuff, and by 1931, the operation had just simply outgrown Robbinsdale. Fawcett Publications packed up its desks, said goodbye to West Broadway, and moved to 529 7th Street South in downtown Minneapolis. And at that point, the company was distributing a staggering 1.5 million magazines every single month.
That same year, Billy divorced his second wife, Antoinette. but his love for trap shooting would soon bring him his final partner. On November 12, 1936, Wilford married his third wife, Frances Marie Mills Robinson. Frances was a Canadian native who moved to America in 1919. The couple had actually met over a decade earlier, back in 1924 in Chicago, where Frances served as the chief clerk of the American Trap Shooting Association. She was a woman who knew her way around high society, having previously been married and divorced from Jimmy Robinson, a trap shooter and owner of a prominent Minneapolis billiards hall.
So there's lots of exciting things happening. Things are changing quickly. And by the mid-1930s, the Fawcett Empire was ready for the biggest stage in the world. On October 9th, 1935, the Minneapolis Times broke the massive news. Fawcett Publishing was moving its entire corporate headquarters to the East Coast, setting up glamorous offices in New York City at 67 West 44th Street, with a massive printing plant in Greenwich, Connecticut. With the move to New York, the company diversified wildly. In 1934 alone, they turned out a massive slate of titles, some of them including Romantic Stories, Movie Story Magazine, For Men Only, Radioland, Screen Book, Screenplay, and Screen Life. By 1936, the changing times meant that readership for the original Captain Billy's Whiz Bang had finally dwindled and Fawcett ceased its publication. So Whiz Bang closes down in 1936. But they replaced the old joke book with a gritty new genre, launching Vice Squad Detective, True Police Cases, Startling Detective, Dynamic Detective, and Daring Detective.
You know, it's worth mentioning in there, too, that True Confessions keeps going through all of this and is still on newsstands today. But Captain Billy Fawcett truly burned the candle at both ends. And on February 7, 1940, during a high-stakes business trip to Los Angeles, California, the great showman caught a severe cold, leading to a fatal heart attack. The original Fawcetteer was gone at the age of 55.
But the Fawcett story didn't end in 1940. In fact, it was about to enter its most legendary era. Captain Billy's five children, Marion, Wilford Jr., Roger, Gordon, and Roscoe, inherited the entire multi-million dollar publishing empire. And they immediately looked toward a booming new medium that was taking newsstands by storm, comic books. His youngest son, Roscoe Fawcett, later recalled exactly how they struck absolute gold. He was the one who pushed them into the business. He told editorial director Ralph Dye and coordinator Al Allard, "Give me a Superman, only have his other identity being a 10 or 12 year old boy rather than a man."
Shazam!
So in-house writer William Parker and artist Charles Clarence Beck did exactly that. They invented Captain Marvel, who made his spectacular premiere in Whiz Comics number 2 in February 1940, the exact month that Captain Billy passed away. Captain Marvel became an overnight sensation, actually outselling Superman himself, and birthed a historic line of Fawcett comic books. There's a whole list of them, including Captain Marvel Jr., Mary Marvel, The Marvel Family, Captain Midnight, Spy Smasher, Bullet Man, Slam Bang Comics, Master Comics, Minuteman Comics, Ibis the Invincible, Funny Animals, Wow Comics, Nickel Comics, and Don Winslow of the Navy.
And through all this massive mid-century success, Captain Billy's daughter, Marion Fawcett, was right there alongside her brothers as an equal co-owner of the empire, while her brothers managed the day-to-day operations and high-profile public relations. Marion lived life deeply connected to the family's enduring legacy.
Marion eventually married a man named Warren A. Bagg, who tragically passed away in 1955. As Marion Fawcett Bagg, she watched the company her father built in that tiny Robbinsdale office scale to unimaginable heights. In 1948, they began to produce Woman's Day magazine and Motion Picture magazine. At that same time, Fawcett Publications sought to reassure a concerned public that comic books did not inspire kids to become juvenile delinquents.
Of course not. On July 27, 1949, the New York Times reported that Fawcett Publications had sold their building at 67 West 44th Street for $2 million to the Tishman Realty Company, but they didn't leave. The building was heavily renovated, and Fawcett signed a 21-year lease to occupy the 50,000 square feet across the top six floors and the luxury penthouse. From the penthouse in 1950, they revolutionized the literary world by launching gold medal books. Instead of reprinting old hardcovers, Gold Medal produced completely original paperback novels. It was a massive gamble that paid off instantly, selling over 9 million paperbacks in its first 6 months alone and expanding into Premier Books, Red Seal, and Crest paperbacks.
By 1952, their magazine racks were packed with Mechanics Illustrated, Cars Magazine, Cavalier, True Magazine for Today's Man, and Today's Woman. But an empire that large always draws giant rivals. For over a decade, Fawcett Comics had been locked in a grueling multi-million dollar copyright lawsuit with DC Comics, who claimed that Captain Marvel was an illegal infringement on Superman. By 1953, facing lost readership, self-censorship across the industry, and the growing popularity of television, Fawcett lost the historic case. They made the tough decision to exit the comic book business forever and printed their final comic books in January 1954.
Yet the family adaptation continued. In 1962, Ralph Day, who had been promoted to chief executive officer at Fawcett Publications, hired Elaine Saunders, the brilliant wife of their legendary pulp illustrator Norman Saunders, to work as a copy editor at Women's Day. By 1966, the magazine was selling a mind-boggling 6 million copies an issue. By 1970, Elaine Saunders had been promoted to chief executive officer at Women's Day Special Interest Magazines, dominating the national market on cooking, knitting, and holiday crafts.
The incredible run finally reached its financial pinnacle on January 8, 1977, when the New York Times broke a final stunning headline. The Columbia Broadcasting System, CBS, had purchased Fawcett Publications for a jaw-dropping $50 million.
Marion lived to see the entire epic story play out. She survived many of her siblings watching from afar as the original Breezy Point Lodge tragically burned to the ground in a devastating fire in 1959 before being completely rebuilt. Her twin brother, Wilford Jr., passed away in 1970 at the age of 62, and Roger followed in 1979 at age 70.
When Marion Fawcett Bagg passed away in 1993 at the advanced age of 85, she left behind a lifetime of memories that stretched all the way back to her childhood summers in the 1920s, watching her dad fly airplanes over Big Pelican Lake and build an empire out of Robbinsdale. Her brother Gordon passed away that very same year at the age of 81, and the youngest sibling Roscoe followed in 1999 at the age of 86, closing the final book on Captain Billy's children.
It's an absolutely unbelievable legacy. The global publishing powerhouse that gave the world Captain Marvel, Gold Medal Books, and Women's Day didn't start on Broadway in New York City. It started right here on West Broadway in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. In the mind of an ex-soldier with $500 and a dream.
It really makes you look at this town a little bit differently. The next time you're driving down West Broadway, you know, just take a look at those historic storefronts and remember the incredible whiz-bang energy that started right here.
Yeah, and maybe we'll see all you guys at Whiz-Bang Days. It's coming up here in July every year in Robbinsdale. Tune in next time as we unearth more forgotten local history from our neck of the woods.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale. Thank you.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
Oh, yeah.